This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 11th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we head to Istanbul, where a second biennial to be held is hoping to put Turkish designers on the map.
With this exhibition where you can see where the future can go to and what you can do with design, I think for the Turkish society it's very important that this is actually happening.
We speak to Murray Moss, who's authored a superb new anthology on Denmark's much-celebrated silversmith, George Jensen.
He made effectively unusable functional objects, which were some of the most beautiful sculpture of the 20th century.
Before going to the print studio of one brand known for the brashness of its patterns as it ventures into wallpapers.
It's about trying to find authenticity within our work and some longevity within designs we do, which are not normal sort of virtues within the fashion system.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. To start the show, we venture to Istanbul. Does design need a new manifesto? Can an emerging design market redefine how we think about the role of design in theory and in everyday life? These are the questions driving Istanbul's second design biennial. A city known for its craft heritage, rapidly changing urban composition, and with connections to virtually every corner of the globe, Istanbul is poised for a meteoric rise on the international design stage, or so it hopes. We sent our Istanbul bureau chief, Joseph Dana, to the exhibition to take the temperature of the design world in Istanbul.
Design is everywhere. Regardless of where we live, design touches all aspects of our lives. So what can a city like Istanbul contribute to the debate about where design should go? The second Istanbul Design Biennial, which opened to great fanfare last week, attempts to answer this question by raising other questions about the direction of design manifestos.
So the title of the biennial is The Future is Not What It Used to Be, and this comes from a book by Paul Valery, written in 1937, called The Reflections on the World Today.
Zoe Ryan is the curator of this year's Istanbul Design Biennial.
When I was invited to curate the biennial last summer, I came across this phrase and thought it was as resonant as it must have been 80 years ago. It was particularly resonant in our time now, in a time of change and potentially unrest. It feels increasingly urgent to kind of look at where we've come from, where we are, and where we've headed. So this biennial very much looks at where we are, where we've come from, and obviously where we're headed. But it doesn't propose solutions or conclusions, rather it opens up questions. And one of the major questions are framed around manifestos. So how can we rethink the manifesto for contemporary life? Rather than just written statements, could they be objects or buildings or environments or even a working process?
From the esoteric to the practical, the biennial set out to facilitate new questions and dialogues that would result in a new design manifesto. As you walk around the biennial, which was housed in the historic Galata Greek Primary School, quotes about the future, about the past, about the present were painted on the walls. But this event was not all about inaccessible design theory. Elif Ansari, along with her Istanbul-based architecture firm, offered a solution for the future that highlighted a radically simple design application unique to Turkey.
The project is about the shorelines of Turkish cities and the relationship of the city with the water. In Turkey, you can see this exact same cross-section when you look at the shoreline, and it's basically a parapet that's separating you from the water. We wanted to think about how we could improve this relationship of the citizens with the water and how we could create an interesting public space that would allow people to use the water in a better way.
One theme that is always present in creative and intellectual discussion in Turkey is the question of preserving craft heritage and its relationship to the rapidly changing urban fate of Istanbul. Crafted in Istanbul is one design response to this debate. Founded with the aim to improve the visibility of Istanbul's dying breed of master craftsmen, this design initiative is the brainchild of Bilal Yilmaz, Standing next to his latest product, a street bench built entirely out of wood, with the street lamp sprouting out of one side, Yılmaz explained the vision of the project.
Crafted in Istanbul is a kind of network system, the craftsman's network system. It's made to make the craftsmen increase their visibility and to bring the designers and the craftsmen together in a working hybrid model. Basically, what we are doing is we are going to the streets, we are finding the craftsmen's studios. We are taking pictures of their studios and taking their coordinates and then putting all this data on a web page. There is two classifications. One is depends on the material, the other one is about what kind of crafts that they are working on. Then we are opening this information for the designers, architects, or anybody who would like to product something with those people. And we are trying to bring those two elements together.
For years, Istanbul has been flouted as one of the locations suitable to become the next big design city. Given the city's vibrancy and craft pedigree, this makes good sense. This year's biennial felt like a statement of emergence. Turkey's best and brightest designers were on full display, as well as a number of foreign designers from across the globe. Rihanna Koons is an Istanbul-based Dutch designer who works with local artisans to create beautifully simple household products. She explains how the biennial is representative of Istanbul's design scene.
I think it's a very, very important event for Istanbul because they have so many chances over here. I do live in Istanbul. I'm totally into this Turkish culture, Turkish society. And what I see is that the last few years, it's actually growing. They have a lot of chances, but so far, they didn't really reach to be as well the ones who innovate things and the ones who design the things. So with this exhibition where you can see where the future can go to and what you can do with design and how you can actually change the society, how you can change environment by products which you bring into the world, let's say, because we are the ones who create them, in combination with all the chances over here, still the knowledge, the handcrafts, the materials, yeah, I think for the Turkish society it's very important that this is actually happening.
Regardless of the high quality on offer in the Istanbul Design Biennial, the exhibition had a clear goal in mind, and that is to wrestle with the idea of the design manifesto. Beth Schechter, a designer with Stamen Design in the United States, was on hand with a project called Mapmaker Manifestos. She explains how the idea of the manifesto was a constant thread throughout this year's exhibition.
What I'm seeing a lot is people really wanting to design a better future for all people, and you see that manifested in so many different ways, through critiques on education, through critiques on the manifesto itself. We're facing unsustainability, and everybody in every project, or at least most of the projects that are here, are really sort of speaking to that. So you can feel that we're all actually really ready for change, and it's really exciting to feel the sense that, you know, design can be a part of that conversation, and even part of the mechanism that brings us to hopefully a more sustainable future. It might be impossible, it might be completely idealistic, but that's what manifestos are all about.
Oftentimes, design biennials can feel bogged down in either esoteric theories or radical but impractical design applications. In Istanbul this year, the design biennial got just the right mix, and in the process created a space for both the general public as well as highbrow design practitioners. The event marks Istanbul's emergence as a major player in the world of design. While the future is not what it used to be, Istanbul's place in it has certainly come of age.
That was Monocle's Istanbul Bureau Chief Joseph Dana reporting from the second Istanbul Design Biennial. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, from one Monocle Bureau to another, as we head to Tokyo for one of our semi-regular regional design updates with Monocle Bureau Chief there, Fiona Wilson. A little earlier, Fiona talked me through some of the latest constructions and controversies that have had the design world talking, and we began by discussing the much-criticised designs for the National Stadium again.
This has just been rumbling on, this whole debate about this very expensive National Stadium. Zaha Hadid won the competition, and then once the sort of details of the design were becoming more widely known, made more public, people started looking at the detail. It turned out to be incredibly expensive. So basically, there's been a 40% cut in the budget, and Zaha Hadid has done a redesign, and a letter that Arata Izasaki, very eminent Japanese architect, an open letter he wrote to the Japan Sports Council, has been published. And I think we can describe it as a blistering attack. The insults range from calling it a monumental disgrace to saying it looks like a turtle, you know, and it's going to be a white elephant, that there's nothing good about Isozaki's comments.
Are people listening? I mean, are sort of the Olympic governing bodies or the sort of senior people in Tokyo listening to the global dislike of what's going to happen with the stadium?
It's so interesting that, isn't it? You know, so many eminent Japanese architects have now waded into this whole discussion. You've had, you know, Toyo Ito, Fumiko Maki, Kengo Kuma, So Fujimoto. You know, everyone's been quite careful to say we're not attacking Zaha Hadid. And Isozaki, you know, the one positive thing perhaps Zaha Hadid could draw from it is that the redesign didn't do her talent justice. A lot of people compared the original design to a squashed bicycle helmet, which wasn't so flattering. But I think the feeling is that it's such a dog's dinner now. What is this stadium? Yes, the budget's been cut, but the problems are still there. It's still 70 metres high at pedestrian level when the limit in that area is supposed to be 15 metres. You know, it's a very green area. There's no getting around it. This is a sort of lawbreaker, this stadium. And no, I would say nobody's really listening. And I think that's what's really enraging the architects at this point. You know, they're pretty much being ignored.
Well, let's move on to another exhibition of homegrown talent of Muji, or one Muji designer.
Well, I mean, Muji's such an interesting company. You look into the history of it, it started out with just, you know, 40 products in 1980. The idea was it would just be no branded quality goods. That's what the name means. Muji Rushi Ryohin means no branded quality goods. The idea was you had very well-designed products, simple, low on unnecessary packaging and no logos. Really, really simple idea. It's just caught on, as everybody in the world now knows. I think there are 200-odd stores around the world and the same again in Japan. And now there are something, you know, thousands of products in the product lineup. And the idea has developed into something really quite profound. I think it's a sort of movement against this, you know, star designer, naming designers. What's interesting about Muji is it attracted very famous designers, but they had to agree not to announce they were designing for Muji. So you had products that were designed by, you know, the likes of Naoto Fukuzawa or Kengo Kuma, Shigeru Ban, Jasper Morrison, all these very famous people. But you didn't actually know they'd done it. If you were interested, you could easily find out. But what was interesting was you just thought, gosh, that's a really well-designed product and it's very reasonably priced. So the whole movement is very interesting. And this exhibition is looking at the work of Masaru Kagaya, not one of the best-known Muji designers, but actually he's designed some of the best-known products. I looked at the list. I mean, I've got many of them in my house. I laughed. You know, even his bicycle I've got. So he's someone that a lot of people know, even if they don't know him, they know his work. So I think this exhibition is just an interesting chance to kind of recap and remember that there is a sort of design team behind all these amazing products.
I want to move on now to the subject of demolition. Let's start with a warehouse in Yokohama.
I just thought this is such an interesting story. Yokohama in itself is an interesting city. It's slightly being swallowed up by Tokyo now. They're next to each other. There's no gap between the two cities anymore. But it does have this distinctive, this port culture. It's a big port city. And it famously had these red brick warehouses on the waterfront. Now, some of them have been saved very successfully, turned into really interesting buildings. They're used for art shows, fairs. Really well done, I think. And I was quite surprised to see that one of these ones, it was built in 1910, is going to be demolished. There was a lot of pressure. A lot of people wanted to save it. And the owners, Ken Corp, who are a very well-known real estate company in Tokyo, have come up with some, you know, fudged excuse that the maintenance is too much and they're just going to demolish it, even though, rather depressingly, they have no plans for the site. So this very interesting building, red brick building, it used to apparently stock raw silk, is going to be demolished. And it just seems such a shame. It's such an interesting part of this city's history. And, you know, you wish somebody would do something to stop this happening, really.
What are sort of the major big preservation societies in Japan? What is the sort of Japanese-English heritage? Or is there one? Because it seems like there kind of needs to be, and they need to be a bit more vocal about saving these.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't anything like that. There's a sort of system of listing. It's very vague. I mean, really, nothing is really open to protection. It's interesting. I think if you've got an old temple or a shrine, that would be fine. But anything else really is very vulnerable to redevelopment. You know, we've been talking about it a lot at Monocle recently. We're very interested in this redevelopment of the Hotel Okura, you know, much more recent building actually from the 60s. But You know, really, the strong movement to protect old buildings has often come from outsiders. You know, I think, say, Europe and the States, where there's much more of a feeling that buildings should be preserved. And I think Tokyo is just such a city of transformation that, you know, often in Japan, people just say, oh, it's a shame, but they don't actually get the placards out. They're not going to, you know, lie in front of the bulldozers to stop these things happening.
That was our Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson, talking us through some of the design stories hitting the headlines where she is. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris, where we'll be back after this short break.
Every weekday at 1800 hours London time, join one of Monocle's editors and their panel of special guests for an in-depth roundtable discussion of the day's key news stories.
It's not the West or the outside, the international community, trying to do something in Iraq. It's about the international community trying to support an Iraqi effort.
Fresh and passionate insight from leading international voices on global affairs, politics and business here in London.
I was in the south, in Sangin, in Helmand province. What I saw there makes me pretty confident that within a year of the troops going, the south will fall to the Taliban.
And of course, we bring you reviews of the best in film, music, theatre and literature from all around the world.
Every single character is an eccentric. It's all, oh, Bagara, she thought her husband was a potato. I'm astonished that it's on the Booker long list.
Hear the sharpest views and insights on the big issues of the day and get up to speed on how to add to your cultural wealth as well. That's all on Midori House, Monday through Friday at 1800 hours London time.
Hello and welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, if you work in design, scarcely a day goes by without the launch of a brand new interior concept. From hotel to home, or from office to coffee shop, the layout, material and furniture choice that a brand or private residence selects seems as vital as the building type or architect. One very large new book hopes to encapsulate some of the best of interior trends by capturing and beautifully illustrating some 100 of the best interior designers out there. No mean feat in such a crowded field. So, publishers Fiden recruited 10 curators from the ranks of journalism and academia to come up with a list of 10 interior designers each. Room Inside Contemporary Interiors, published by Fiden, is the result. Earlier, David Pleasant spoke to one of the book's curators, Federico Duarte, who's a design critic based in Lisbon.
When I was invited to be one of the 10 curators of this book, I have to say I was a bit skeptical of the term interior design. But what interests me in the Fiden's concept for the book was that interiors can be all sorts of different things and can actually be created by all sorts of different disciplines. And they can be permanent, they can be temporary, they can be luxurious, but they can also be part of our everyday. Well, it doesn't mean that luxury is not part of everyday, but depends who you are, I guess. So in a sense, my contribution was, and I was concerned on giving a very broad version of what an interior or a room can be. And so in that sense, the 10 projects I selected kind of expressed that.
Could you go into some of those projects that you selected? Were you kind of bound by a kind of regional quota? Did you feel you had to cover the region you know best?
I was. In that sense, there was a slant to the invitation, which was kind of tapping on my knowledge of Brazilian design, and especially Brazilian product and furniture design, but also architecture, and kind of go into Brazil and also a bit of Latin America and have an emphasis on projects from that region. Having said that, some of the projects, for example, one of the projects, actually one of my favorite projects, is the Brazilian Pavilion in the Frankfurt Book Fair, the 2013 Frankfurt Book Fair. And this was created by an architect duo, Danielle Thomas and Felipe Tassara, in conjunction with a team of graphic designers and, of course, the curators of the pavilion. And it's a beautiful temporary structure that only lasted for the time of the fair. And that, for me, was really instrumental in giving a very different idea of what Brazil was, or is, actually. And talking to Daniela, and she expressed their concern with really giving a different idea of a modern cosmopolitan Brazil as opposed to sometimes the stereotype many people have, including in the literary world, of what Brazil is. So in that sense, I was very glad to include this project in the book because it's showing that a room can actually have a statement. It's just not interior design. It's not just a decoration, let's say, which is sometimes what many people misjudge interior design for.
So obviously one project really kind of breaking boundaries perhaps and doing something a little bit out of the mould. But I wanted to go on to and perhaps touch on that scepticism that you mentioned with a book of this type. No matter how kind of stunning or kind of really interesting a project might be, is there a danger that when it's put in a volume like this, it tends to drown out and there's a kind of feeling almost of repetition? And does that mean that this is really a reference book? Is it something that people can delve in and out of?
I sure hope so. I think, for example, this question of, and for me, in dialogue with the editors of the book, was this idea of multidisciplinarity, of this interior design not being just made or practiced by a specific discipline within design, which is a bigger world of design, but can actually be shaped and by different designers. For example, another project that I chose was the D-Edge nightclub in São Paulo, which was designed by Muti Randolph, who's he's kind of a maestro in that sense of that he creates environments and spaces and sometimes just things like, for example, graphics for live performances. And in that sense, he does create an idea of a space. And in this sense, with this nightclub, it was interesting how, for example, the concept in terms of authorship is his. And then he teamed up with different specialties, being architects, software designers, programmers, to actually achieve this idea of the nightclub as a machine for dancing. That's a term that I use. And in that sense, I hope that the people who pick up Room will kind of also challenge their preconceptions and misconceptions of what interior design is and can be.
And do you think, in terms of those people who are going to pick up the book, do you see it appealing to designers, to potential clients, to the buyers of design or those interested? Who do you think's the kind of person that this is geared towards?
That's a very good question. I think sometimes these very big books, you know, the so-called coffee table books, they tend to be showpieces. They tend to be also a promotional item, for example, for the clients of these specific projects. But also I think it's a sort of inspiration for designers, students even. I think I always like to stress that students should also pick up these books, even if it's inside the library. There's a case to be made in the age that we live of the internet, of architecture and design blogs, where we see these projects reproduced daily. It's nice to have actually a selection that was selected for you, the reader, by, in this case, 10 different people, and that you have some comments of us and saying, this is why this project matters. And I think in that sense, there's still a very good role that these books can play.
Well, absolutely. And I think a lot of our listeners will agree with you with that promotion of the print publication. Finally, can we talk about interior design trends, anything that we kind of see as kind of notions or kind of concepts that are kind of going across regions, across designers?
Yeah, I think there's a case to be made about trends. And that's why also I tried to, for example, include an exhibition by Raumlabo, who's this this collective of architects from Berlin. They were kind of intrigued, and I reached out to them saying, I'd like to highlight your project as part of an interior design book. And they were like, oh, really? So in the sense that the exhibition design is an extremely important branch of what we can call interior design, because it is the design of spaces, of rooms. And that's why I really like the title of this room, because it doesn't pull you into the interior design category. Having said that, this project is very, very different from anything else. You may say that, for example, there can be trends, it can be, you know, it can be the international modernism that came out of the 90s that's still around. I think it has a good case to be made that interiors should still be designed. And then it's sometimes quite hard to find people who are willing to invest in someone to design a space, be it temporary or permanent, and how an individual interpretation of what a space can be can really change your experience. And another project, for example, that I chose was actually the only project in my native country, in Portugal, which was actually designed by Marcio Kogan's team from Brazil. And it's the interiors of a hotel, which doesn't look like it's in Portugal, but it doesn't look... it looks totally right for the place. So you can say it imbues a lot of the trends in, for example, rediscovering 1960s furniture, using natural, non-treated materials. But then you say, for example, what is this space trying to do? if it's a hotel, is it trying to make you feel comfortable? Yes. If so, it works. That was kind of one of my concerns of the projects that I chose was, what are these projects trying to say and why are they relevant? In that sense, I didn't really try to say if they follow or if they are against the trend, but I really tried to go on a case-by-case basis.
That was David Pleasant speaking to Federico Duarte, one of the curators of Feiden's huge new volume, Room Inside Contemporary Interiors. Still to come today, we'll be taking a careful look at the designs of Danish silversmith George Jensen, examining some rather fine homeware by new collaboration Ruby Tree, and heading into the studio of fashion and printing duo Ely and Kishimoto. Danish silverware brand George Jensen is this year celebrating 110 years in the business. Beginning life in turn-of-the-century Denmark as a purveyor of ornate homeware, the brand expertly moved through the years to become an icon of Danish mid-century design, and today continues to be known for its well-crafted pieces and for working with an expert array of young talent. To mark the anniversary, New York-based designer and retailer Murray Moss has edited Reflections, a sumptuous hardback tome documenting 110 shiny years of George Jensen. He joined me in the studio earlier to discuss how he put the book together.
It's called Reflections, and I talk about it as a sort of imagined truth, which is a kind of contradiction in terms, and I talk about it as a rumination, but the thing is I made it up. I made it up because I wanted Jensen to go through a filter of the human mind, mm-hmm. You know. I didn't want it to be an absolute truth written, passed on from the mount, where written in stone is the truth of Jensen, the history. Because in point of fact, there have been many books written in the 110 years of this incredible company. And I thought it was important for people and the Jensen Company, George Jensen and the directors were very supportive and brave to allow me to give a personal response to this evolution, the history of Jensen. George Jensen began in 1904. So it happens to parallel the history of the 20th century. Mm. Sort of day by day, for 40,000 plus days, every day, George Jensen was responding to what's going on today in the world. And we know that history, which has been written in many different ways, it's written in a very unique way through these objects.
Mm. And I think this idea of collaboration is so important to the company, and the fact that, you know, again, seeing it in the book, it's the amount of amazing people that they've collaborated with. Who are some of your favorites? What are some of your favorite pieces in the book some collections?
I personally, Murray, would be satisfied if there was only Henning Koppel. Mm. Like, it isn't that I would dismiss the rest. I love things. But Henning Koppel did extraordinary work. And it was, the guy was a sculptor. He couldn't support his family doing sculpture. So Jensen said, you know something, we'll let you do the sculpture for us and we'll call it a serving, a fish platter. So maybe it'll do better as a fish platter. That you don't have to change anything, do your sculpture, but we'll say you could serve fish with it. So Henning Koppel thought that was a good idea. And in fact, that's what he did. He made effectively unusable, outrageously priced, awkward, functional objects, which were some of the most beautiful sculpture of the 20th century.
Yeah, and yes. I guess that's part of, you know, it's why all Danish design is so amazing. It's bringing that sense of art form and artistic creativity to the functional everyday. And some of, I think, the best Danish designers have always done that. How have you, when you're sort of turning that into a book, because this kind of feels more like an art book in some ways, but, you know, most of the things in it are sort of pieces of homeware.
Yeah.
What were the sort of challenges of bringing that to life with art direction, of sort of taking a slightly more artistic approach?
Well, I was very fortunate because that wasn't my domain, but there was a, from the beginning, which originated with, you know, Robert Wolf and his team, we clicked. When I said, I would not like to write a linear history. I would like to jump around. I'd like to talk about people. They responded to that. They said, let's do that. When I say I wanted to write a book, I wanted to write a love story. I wanted to write Romeo and Juliet. Murray's Romeo and Juliet. Why we fall in love, human beings, with inanimate objects, with a different species. And subsequently to writing the book, I realized that I made a mistake, that we don't fall in love with inanimate objects. We fall in love with the human imagination and intellect that created those objects. This led me onto the trail, the scent of the following the objects that I love, the fish platter, the eel, etc. It led me on the trail to who the people were that imagined these. So I wrote about them because I thought we should know that's the love story.
I mean, the book is called Reflections, but the company is still as sort of vibrant on the scene, as important as ever has been. My sort of last question is, you know, you must get approached to do sort of books like this all the time. What attracted you to do it? Why do you still in love with the contemporary side of George Jensen?
A piece of George Jensen is like a book or a souffle or an embrace or an idea that you have. It's alive. It's everything other than what it seems. It's not a thing to me. It's a souvenir. In the 19th century use of that term, a souvenir, a remembrance, a manifestation of some exceptional human imagined idea. That's why I was begging to do it.
That was industrial designer and entrepreneur Murray Moss talking to me about the new book Reflections, published to mark 110 years of George Jensen, which is out now. This is Monocle 24 and you're listening to Section D. With its fine pedigree as the ultimate luxury emporium, Harrods in London is a fitting place to launch a new design and craft collaboration. The Ruby Tree is the name of a new brand and its first collection is as simple as it is delicate and luxurious. One of our favourite British designers, Bethan Gray, spoke to Monocle's Max Koshik about her collaboration with the India-based Islamic craft expert and manufacturer Abdul Karim, discovering her love for semi-precious stones and what an in-flight magazine from the Philippines had to do with the whole Ruby Tree story.
My name's Bethan Gray and I'm a designer and I've been working with Abdul Karim on the Ruby Tree collection, which we're launching in Harrods. My background is mainly with furniture and I enjoy working with natural materials such as marble and stones.
How did this collaboration come to place? How did you get to meet and how did you get to work together?
It's a nice coincidence of how we met. Abdul Karim's friend was on holiday in the Philippines and she took an internal flight and picked up the in-flight magazine and the cake stand from my Black and White Alice collection, a collection using black and white marble in very geometric graphic patterns. And she cut it out and stuck it on a postcard, sent it to Delhi, and just wrote, why don't you get in touch with this designer? And so he did, and he sent me a very long email explaining that he had the best craftsman in the world, so that was enough for me, and that he thought I'd had a subliminal attraction to Islamic art. And he was totally right. I didn't realise. And that's where the inspiration for these designs came from.
So your designs are very geometrical, but they're kind of also very exotic.
Yeah. The petal design is inspired by a mosque in Isfahan, the Sheikh Loftola Mosque, and it is amazing. So there's a pattern on the interior of the dome, and that's what's inspired the petal design. So it's an array of petal shapes spiraling within a circle. They're getting smaller and smaller as they go in. I've just simplified it by using the semi-precious stone. So in this design, we've got lapis lazuli, which is a beautiful blue semi-precious stone from Afghanistan. it's from the same mine that they found lapis in Tutankhamun, and it's a really beautiful colour. And Abdul Karim is working with a lot of the lapis, so we've had the best colour that there is in lapis. And I've repeated this pattern over a lot of products on the dining table, as well as the platter and the bowl. And when it's layered on layer, it looks really striking.
We can see here that you have used this kind of pattern not only in the lapis and marble collection, but you also have one that is very simplistic, like a kind of variation of it in different colours. We have here a range of bowls.
Sure, this one here is we're using rose quartz as the petal that's inlaid within the bowl. And it's beautiful because it's translucent, so you can see through the pink quartz, which is really a much subtler, softer colour. Then we've got some bowls that are carved but don't have any semi-precious stones in them, which are beautiful in a very simple way. And then we have one which we call the open jali, where it's cut all the way through and it's very, very geometric and graphic.
Right next to this petal collection, we have another one, very modern, very geometric. I like this kind of really vibrant colours. How did you come to use this sort of green colours, and where did you get this inspiration for this very geometrical design?
The stripe inspiration came from bowls that I had seen in Sotheby's last year. It was Islamic Week, and it was coincided when I was doing my research for the project. And I found these amazing bowls that were made from ceramic with a blue stripe glaze, and it's very simple. And I couldn't believe that they came from between the 11th and 13th century. And I was taken aback by that design, so I've used that as inspiration for the stripe. And when I went to Jaipur to see the workshop and look at all the materials, I found this green turquoisey stone called Amazonite. And I'd never seen it before, and it's so striking that I wanted to use it with black marble to really highlight and see this contemporary pattern with these very striking colours.
You say yourself, through your collaboration with Mr. Kreutz, you just sort of discovered your own fascination with the Middle East. How would you describe your work before this eye-opening collaboration?
I've always had a love of natural materials, and I wanted to highlight some of these materials in some way. So, for instance, Alice Black and White Collection, which is a range of chopping boards and cheese boards that use black and white marble. That was actually inspired by Italian churches, which are also made with two different stones and that whole graphic nature. So it's funny that I've been inspired by churches and mosques and lots of historic buildings.
So now that you've also found this supplier of craftsmanship and materials, how do you want to proceed? Do you have any plans for the future for your collaboration?
We're already working on some new pieces using the stripe pattern, but on a fountain. We're working on a modular fountain that can be bigger or smaller depending on the size of your palace or hotel. And we're able to make bespoke pieces with different stones depending on what the end customer wants. So we're working on larger scale outdoor pieces like fountains and lanterns, where the pattern will create an amazing shadow with either candlelight or wired in light. They're the next steps for the Ruby Tree.
That was Monocle's Max Koschick speaking to Bethan Gray, the designer of the new homeware collaboration Ruby Tree, at the launch in Harrods in London. This is Section D on Monocle 24, where we'll return straight after this.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
Now, to end this episode of Section D, we're going to delve into a designer's studio, as we like to do from time to time on the show. With its swirling, jagged, two-tone, houndstooth-like pattern from 2001, called Flash, fashion brand Eli Kishimoto became famous for producing loud and provocative prints. A decade and a half down the road, the label's husband and wife team, Mark Ely and Wakako Kishimoto, are venturing into the production of beautifully crafted wallpaper. Given the printing expertise and flair they've acquired over the years, this might come as a little surprise. David Pleasant went down to Brixton in South London to ponder on patterns and scrutinise screen printing.
We're fundamentally textile designers, practising in many mediums that allows itself to transcend to focusing on pattern and surface decoration.
And that's been mainly focused on fashion and women's wear, has it? And kind of dressmaking, pattern cutting, that kind of field?
Women's wear collection has always been the important part of our business. But from the very beginning, we have always had a sort of tendency to sort of expand to other area, not just because we want to make ourselves big. It's just purely because we're interested in other things other than fashion.
And if we talk about those patterns, I see little snippets of textiles and patterns around. Maybe if you can kind of sum it up, it's always so difficult to put words to something so visual, but if you can sum up the types of patterns, the types of things that you explore, themes in your work, how would you do that?
It's kind of easier by reading other people's sort of announcements of what we do. So I'd sort of go back on that. It's kind of graphic, light of heart, a sense of humour, colourful, repeating units.
And there is the kind of what's become your sort of iconic pattern, would you say? This sort of abstracted, kind of morphed houndstooth that might be familiar to people when they hear your name. Is that still a kind of centrepiece of what you do?
Flash is kind of, it was designed in 2001 for a spring-summer collection, and it was an exercise of rights that go beyond fashion to try to allow it to exist after fashion collection was finished and sold. So therefore, it's about trying to find authenticity within our work and some longevity within designs we do, which are not normal sort of virtues within the fashion system. So therefore, we took it out of that season, we jumped onto wallpapers, and it went onto toys and cars and phones. And now it has a life of its own, love it or hate it.
Sometimes with these big works that really sort of put people in the spotlight, people can feel a bit burdened by them in a way because you can't break free from it. Or for you, has it been is it a constant source of inspiration? Do you look at it as a sort of reference point?
Yeah, the love or hate part of it is, okay, there's obviously an honest part of that because that's just one of like sort of 100 to 200,000 or whatever, hundreds of designs that we have in our archive that we've generated on equal terms as a Flash. But the provocation that it creates, like sort of 13, 14 years on, and the partners and the friendships that it creates and makes for our company is still kind of invigorating. So I can't really damn it that much. And it's like natural. It's like one of those things that happens to any brand, something has an icon, such as your monogram at Monocle, etc. So therefore, it's something that we have to embrace and keep on going and making sure that when we put it out there or people see it, it does have integrity and sense of heart of our studio, wherever it goes.
If we talk about that process, that handcrafted element, we're surrounded by your studio. Maybe we can go into how that actually happens, whether it's wallpaper, whether it's textiles for dresses or so on. How does it all begin? Is it on a computer screen? Are you drawing things? Are you cutting things physically? Maybe explain to the listeners how it's born, the pattern.
All activity do start off initially from manual work, whether it's a drawing in a sketchbook. I'm not going to lie, we don't use computers, but it's almost like a tool to carry out your creativity to kind of fit into sort of everybody else's what they're doing, because, you know, you can't nowadays. But we will still manually cut fabrics, paint. I pay a lot of money to buy some expensive gouache still. We sew, we have a sort of machinist go in there, so that we have print room downstairs, which we can sort of take you downstairs later. Fabric's been printed, finished and dried, come up here, being cut here on this table.
So we're leaning against this big table, so we're kind of doing it in reverse order. We'll talk about the printing a bit later, but so this is the
kind of heart of the operation, would you say? Is it like a kitchen table in a house almost?
This table basically is just a cutting table, so therefore it's primarily used for storing things.
Or to have cups of tea on.
Exactly. It's where the patterns get cut for the garments. This is kind of why it's so big, and it's like people can lay out. And first of all, the execution of the drawing, the illustration, which then goes into technical drawing, then goes into a physical card pattern, which is the architecture of a garment. That's what happens on this table. And then the fabric gets rolled out, and then we cut the fabric out to put to the sewing room, which goes there. There's a flow that kind of happens in the studio. Like, we're very self-contained, and we're quite good at manufacturing product. From wax head, for an imagination, from a story or a narrative, through to a physical sketch or an idea in a sketchbook, which then gets elevated into either going downstairs into the print room to make screens, or comes into the fashion area to make a garment, or it becomes an illustration, which then eventually goes onto a building, or it becomes a lift shaft, or it becomes a carpet, or it becomes a car. So therefore, it becomes a watch. So the narrative of, or the physicality of wax creation in terms of her drawing ability and understanding the hand and sort of mind kind of association to make something three-dimensional on paper, we enjoy the physicality of making it happen within the studio to the best of our ability. Hence the production of the garments and production of the wallpapers, which are the mainstay. But then we find partnerships, or we have friends within the industry that then can manufacture the glass, can manufacture the pot, can manufacture the watch. But they still, they have the processes that we can't or are not capable of providing ourselves. So that's the way that we work in the studio. It's basically very hands-on. It's about the beauty of the production of the craft as well as the finished product. So this room is the design room with the finishing and the cutting table and sewing room. On the ground floor, we have the print room. We're in the print room now. This is basically the screen loading area. We have the carousel T-shirt printing machine. We have the drying racks. And also then we go in. The main space is this area. It's basically the dye lab. Within the dye lab, we have substrates which can print fabric, paper, wood, clay, ceramic. So therefore, there's chemistry within this, which is very technical to the processes we put on within the tables next door. And the knowledge of that particular basis of understanding what can be put through a screen and how that substrate relates to the product that you're printing on is really important to us to get a good finish, or to get something which is considered rather than just commercially idealized.
So now you're talking about kind of mixing unique sort of colours and textures. Is that something that can't be replicated very easily? Do the colours within the patterns vary from, if you rerun a pattern, say, a few years down the road, will it be slightly different to the first time you did it?
Yeah, it's a beautiful handcraft, I think. As much as stringent sort of a recipe taken, something affects it, something happens in the steamer, it's too wet, too dry, different bat, yeah, all sorts. That makes us laugh or cry.
So sometimes it must be frustrating. You can't quite get that same pink or yellow or whatever. Yeah,
very frustrating.
No, it's not so. We kind of accept that. It's kind of the happy accidents. Anything which is done by hand actually has an element of that touch. And I'd rather have a pair of jeans with a slight flaw in it, knowing that flaw is unique, rather than to mass produce kind of like something's got through. Basically, what this area allows us to do is to technically attract colour and pattern to substrate. So therefore, we don't have to rely on the services of anybody else to help us manufacture our work, really. So we can do it all in-house.
Going on to another room, this is the screen print.
The two tables, they're ex-St. Martin's tables that we've adopted over the years.
Huge tables, we should point out. I mean, I don't know how many metres in length.
Two 10-metre tables, one's 120 width, the other one's 150 width. The 120 width, Steve, our master printer, who started us 2 years ago, basically saw this table full of rubbish, because we were just working on a large one, and he cleaned it and he said, I can print paper. So therefore, we've utilised his expertise in printing paper.
So one table is for text fabrics and one's for paper.
Yeah, we can put wooden things on both tables as well, but that's primarily what they're used for on a day-to-day basis.
What's your favourite part of the day?
My favourite part of the day is just something's kind of been put together for the first time, just the scene in front of you.
End result here.
And the result in sort of not in a commercial sense, but kind of when things are kind of put together, like I say, you know, print, the pattern, everything is kind of put together and just in front of you. That's when I feel the happiest.
And finally, we do like to get a flavour of what sort of sights and sounds you kind of work with. Do you listen to music while you work? Is there something playing, or do you prefer a very quiet, silent atmosphere?
In the print room, it's always Radio 4, isn't it?
Radio 4.
Radio 4 in the print room. In the middle floor, there's Radio 6 and WAC sort of listens independently to a piano music. On the top floor, there's a combination of Radio 4, FIP Radio, Soho Radio, and some of my friends' tunes they gift me.
That was David Pleasant taking a tour of the Ely Kishimoto studio in Brixton, South London. And that's all we have time for on today's Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer David at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris, and to play you out, we have a selection from Mark Ely, who we just heard from. The Museum of Love with the Who's Who of Who Cares. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.